We have featured on our altar today an extra picture of Lahiri Mahashaya, which is just below the altar. You can see it there. It's actually a painting from the photograph, which is to your left. Lahiri Mahashaya, this is behind us, as most of you know, is a lineage of masters inspired first by Christ, then Babaji, the deathless master who lives even now in the Himalayas. Lahiri was Babaji's direct disciple. Excuse me. Sri Yukteswar, who holds the same place on the opposite side from Lahiri, was Yogananda's guru, and Yogananda's at the bottom of the cross, and of course Jesus is in the middle. These are all self-realized masters whose particular teaching and blessing is the power behind what we do now. Swami Kriyananda, who's the founder of Ananda, whom we often refer to, is a direct disciple of Yogananda, but he emphasizes his role as a disciple, and therefore his picture is not in the lineage. He's not an avatar. The line of gurus was completed with Yogananda's coming, which is not to say there won't be any more gurus in this tradition. It's just on a more subtle level that the project was launched by this board of directors, as one friend of mine calls them. The guys on the wall, sometimes people say, many different colloquial, friendly expressions. Lahiri's picture is emphasized today because the 26th of September is the anniversary of the day that Lahiri Mahashaya was born, and the 30th of September, 4 days later, but several decades later, is the anniversary of the day in which he died. The death of a fully realized master is called the Mahasamadhi. Samadhi is entering into the state of cosmic consciousness, and Maha means great, and the final samadhi, the final expansion of consciousness into the infinite without return. The great masters go into that state of cosmic consciousness, but they maintain life force in the body and then will come back and animate the body, or they'll be in the state of complete union with God, but still be animating their body. But at some point, the cycle of that body is over, and they will die. To human eyes, they'll die. But they actually are just going into the final samadhi. I often think that in some future higher age than the one we're living in, these 4 days will be some kind of a special holiday. Lahiri Mahashaya was the guru in this lineage who was drawn to the Himalayas by his guru Babaji. Of all the masters on the altar, the story that Yogananda tells of Babaji is that Babaji continues to live. By his yogic power, he regenerates his body, and he still inhabits a body even at this time. Yogananda describes him in Autobiography of a Yogi as living in the Himalayas with a band of very advanced disciples, including a few Americans, which is a phrase I always love, because you think of some American child being born in Cleveland, Ohio, or Danbury, Connecticut, or Austin, Texas, and now inhabiting the Himalayas with Babaji. But Lahiri Mahashaya was mystically drawn to the mountains and got lost in the mountains and then was called to where Babaji and his disciples were. And then under very uplifting and miraculous circumstances, Lahiri was initiated into the technique of Kriya Yoga. At that time, Lahiri was living in Varanasi. He had a wife and 2 sons, and he had a job as a government accountant. He was 30 years old. Somehow the little human touches, like he had a job as a government accountant. You think, how did the consciousness of a master end up being a government accountant? But the paths are many. Truth is one, but the paths are many. But once Lahiri was in the presence of Babaji, in the Himalayas, his assumption was that he would never go back to that life, that he would simply have been lost in the mountains as far as the world was concerned, and he would be reunited with his guru and live in that exalted atmosphere. Now, when the masters act out these stories, they're not acting them out with exactly the same attitude in which we, for example, act out our stories. Our ultimate destiny is no less exalted, but the karma that moves us We are compelled by that karma. The difference between us and a master, Jesus phrased it, that he was born without sin, which has lent itself to quite wild misinterpretations. But his statement was really entirely yogic in its context, which is, all souls are compelled to be born because they have irresistible, we have irresistible desires. We all know what an irresistible desire is, don't we? An irresistible desire is the resolution that I'm not going to do this anymore until I do it again. And then it has become an irresistible desire. And these range, you know, from enormous life-threatening actions to just trivial actions, like I'm going to put away half of this sandwich and eat it later. And then all of a sudden it's gone. An irresistible desire. Well, that simple example expands out to the reasons why we end up on this planet at all. We're in the astral world between our incarnations and everything is going just dandy. We're in an atmosphere that's exactly harmonious with our own vibrations. The astral world, I often think of it as like an extended trip to Hawaii, where everything is just so lovely. I understand, I've been told that the actual flowers in Hawaii emanate a kind of, not quite an opiate, but something close to it, so that you just feel really content there, doing pretty much nothing. Before the missionaries came and brought all the terrible diseases and put the natives in muumuus and all the other things that they did, Swamiji described Hawaii as like not quite incarnating on the material plane. You know, think how much energy we have to spend to feed and clothe ourselves and build housing and so on. The time before the white people came and wiped them out, it was just an idyllic, like a paradise. You could eat from what grew naturally, you could fish from the sea, you needed almost nothing to wear, nothing to cover yourself. It was exquisitely beautiful. It was sort of like, I need to incarnate, but not quite. I'm just going to go kind of hang out on the Hawaiian Islands and just kind of run a little bit of a relaxing story, and then maybe later I'll go to New York. And that is sort of what it's like. I know a friend of mine who was doing very, very dynamic nonprofit work in the Bay Area, at great effort and expense, moved his entire operation to Hawaii with the thought that it would be a more sattvic atmosphere to do it. He moved the whole thing back in 6 months. He said not only were they becoming utterly non-productive, he said he was forgetting even why it mattered. And he felt it was important to get home before that happened. But in any case, there we are in the astral world and everything is just fine, but then some little thought crosses our mind. You know, we just remember maybe one of our astral buddies is already reincarnated and he's no longer with us, and we begin to long for his company. Or maybe he was someone that we've always had a crush on and a secret desire to marry, and we also notice that our arch rival Sally has also disappeared from the astral world and we become quite concerned, you know. And even though we say to ourselves, it's all just fine, you know, it's all just divine light and I'm so content here, the next thing you know, you're in a womb, wondering, making a little body, and then you're being held in somebody's arms and some face you've seen before, but not quite in this context, is going, goo, 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 goo. You're looking at them, how did this happen? Some irresistible desire. But the masters, it's entirely different for them. And it's entirely different for them, you have to understand, not because they were created out of something other than us. This is the enormous mistake that out of sincere devotion, but extremely false understanding, religion, as opposed to true spirituality, tries to elevate their leaders. So Jesus was no longer born of Mary and Joseph, but it was an immaculate conception. Now, the immaculate conception actually applies to Mary. I didn't even realize this. One always assumes, if you're a non-Catholic and weren't trained in this, that the immaculate conception was Jesus. No, it was Mary, because even Mary, as the mother of Jesus, had to be completely outside what people think of as human life and sexual desire and all of that messy physicalness. It had to all be completely separate. So Jesus, the whole birth of Jesus just goes way into another dimension, and then Mary goes into another dimension. This is not the sole property of Christians. You know, the Hindus do that with their incarnations, and the story of the life of Buddha is exactly the same, and everything. It's no doubt that when these great souls are born into the world, the experience for the mother and father who birthed them is quite different. It's very interesting, Swamiji's own mother, Swami Kriyananda's mother, because of course Swami obviously had an extraordinary spiritual destiny, and he writes that even as a child, even as his earliest memories are that when he would go to sleep at night, he would go into a superconscious state. He said that he, as a little child, he would lie awake at night and this beautiful light would appear before his closed eyes. And then that light would expand and expand until he was completely absorbed in it. And he, as he put it, it was so natural to him, he thought this is what it meant to go to sleep. And it was many years before he found out that this isn't what happened to other people. There came a point in his life when he was 9 years old, when he began to realize that his reality was so different than the reality of the world around him, that he began to feel some inner need to try to relate to the world that was around him. A kind of karmic necessity set in. And at the same time, as he describes in his own autobiography, he became ill and experienced fever-induced delirium and became anxious about altered states. In any case, he abandoned the practice. But later, when he was initiated into Kriya by his own guru and meditated and went into superconsciousness, he describes it so poignantly. He says, I entered the exact state of consciousness that I remembered from my childhood. And he said it wasn't merely that it was the same state of consciousness, it was the same moment. No time had passed, because in that state of awareness there is no time. Isn't that just an intriguing thought? That just, he's 22 now, practicing Kriya, and the same experience. And everything that had happened in between was perceived as a dream, that this was the only reality that he touched. So you have, to go where I was going, you have these great masters or great souls like Swamiji, whose incarnation is deliberately chosen, perhaps not with no karma at all, but nonetheless not compelled, but chosen. The masters simply feel this inner call of compassion, and they're responsive to the uplifted prayers. A prayer of love went up from earth, and God responded, and you responded. A ray of your light flashed out from infinity, burst through night skies of consciousness, and was born on earth for the redemption of mankind. That's the call that goes up from human souls and is responded to by the birth of an avatar. Well, this particular line of masters that inspires this work has a particular mission at this particular time, and Lahiri Mahashaya played this key role in it, because the practice of Kriya Yoga, which is a particular technique of meditation and a whole approach to the spiritual path, the principle of Kriya Yoga behind it is this, which is that spirituality is an individual responsibility. No institution, no priest, no promise from authorities, no transfer of funds, nothing can ensure spirituality. The only thing that can ensure the experience of God is the inner commitment to experience it. And we don't just have to thrash about wildly because, I know what I was starting to say. An avatar becomes an avatar by walking through the exact experiences that we are walking through. And the religions do us a disservice when they take away from us the understanding that those that we revere as masters simply represent the end of the path that we ourselves are walking. The inevitable result of the work we're doing now is for us to reach that state of consciousness in our Festival of Light, Here then, no greater love can there be than this, from a life of infinite joy and freedom in God, willingly to embrace limitation, pain, and death for the salvation of mankind. Such ever has been the sacrifice of the great masters for the world. There is the infinite spirit and this individualized consciousness that walked the earth as a human being and lived compelled by karma, even as we live. But gradually, by the perseverance and the unremitting application of devotion and willpower and self-discipline, transcended this illusion of limitation and reached that infinite state, but then felt such compassion for the plight of all of us who are still with semi-blind eyes groping around in the dark, trying to hold on to that soul call. And so a prayer of love goes up from earth, and these souls respond. But then the next line of the festival is, here then is the fourth and last stage of the soul's long journey, which is every one of us will reach that state of realization. And so we live in this interesting place between recognizing that this is a path of self-realization. It's our own inner nature that we're going to realize. And yet, at the same time, we have pictures on our altar of other beings, seemingly, as people sometimes say, putting them on a pedestal or worshiping, which nowadays is not a popular concept. But what they represent to us is the completion of the task that we're engaged in and the consciousness which we ourselves will attain. And it's the most obvious thing in the world that if someone has mastered what you're trying to master, and they've mastered it, and the very nature of it is to master compassion and the art of giving back what you have received, that if one is serious about one's own efforts, you're going to reach out for the help which is being offered. That's why in the Bible it says about Jesus, to all who received him, to them gave he the power to become the Christ, to become the Son of God, just as Jesus himself was. The Son of God was how Jesus tried to describe his individuality and at the same time his unity with the infinite, that he was the offspring of the infinite, and therefore that which belonged to his Father also belonged to him. But that word received is the key word. Because you see, it doesn't make any statement about Jesus discriminating as to who he'll give it to. It's a freely offered, constantly vibrating gift of divine consciousness. And whether or not we remain compelled by our desires, or whether we find ourselves gradually and then suddenly completely freed from those compulsions, is entirely a question of how much we receive. How much courage we have in our dedication to this truly other path. And Lahiri's role in this was, there he was in the mountains and he thought he would stay. And Babaji said, no, the time has come. And this was in the mid-1800s, just, 200 years ago, 150 years ago. He said, you must go back to your job as a government accountant, to your wife, to your children, and continue to live that life. And then now give out to others this key of Kriya Yoga, this inner practice which cuts through all of this confusion, because these compelling karmas that we have rise to the level of thoughts. They rise to the level of a desire for this and a fear of that and an anxiety about this and a great longing for that and a fury about this. But all of that is just vibrations of energy from our own actions over many incarnations. Just think how many imprints there are on our consciousness even now. I know those of you who've raised children and you think happily and sadly of the experiences of your children. Perhaps you've lost a loved one. Maybe somebody has betrayed you. Maybe you have treated someone else unkind. Just all the different things when we can shut our eyes and all of these past experiences influence the flow of our consciousness. Isn't it so? I mean, I certainly, I, I can recall you're walking down the street or you're taking a walk somewhere and suddenly you find yourself reliving some reality. Either an argument that you really didn't go the way you wanted it to go, or you're running, oh, I wish I hadn't done that, if that had only not happened, or why didn't, just anything that takes you out of the present moment and takes you off of the inner bliss of the absence of all of those things. But all of those realities, where do they exist? Where can you find an experience that's long past, that was acted out by people who are not those same people anymore? Where can you find it? You find it inside your own mind, but where it really emanates from is the vibration that you yourself implanted on your inner self, which is in the chakras, in the divine centers that line the spine. And they're just little vortices of energy. The ego has this thought, I did this, this affects me, I am identified with these experiences. This happened and now it defines me. Isn't that how it is? We're defined by those experiences. We're defined by our likes and our dislikes and our longings and our disappointments and our capacity to give love, because they are literally the vibrations of our own nature. And so we try to work all these things out by living through them. And we have these compelling karmas. We're incarnate and we have this great desire, oh, to have children and raise them in a certain way, or to make money, or to have a home in a certain place, or to have a certain kind of beauty. I saw this picture of an aspiring movie star once, and I looked at her face and her body and her whole demeanor. She was dressed, as it were, in something that was made out of fake leopard skin. It was so appropriate. She just looked like a feline. She was intensely feline and wildly sort of predator. So, you know, she just had this female sexuality, smoldering sexuality that's so popular. I don't have any idea who she was. This was all in a photograph. I thought, boy, you have been working on this for a long time. You know, you have been refining that body and that whatever it is, you know, that comes out of her. It was just so different than the ordinary female. It was all focused toward this profound reality that she really wanted, you know, that just lifetime after lifetime, other people got the parts because she wasn't tall enough, her hair wasn't the right color, she didn't work hard enough, and just building up of these realities. So we live it out, and this is the karmic experience we have, so the things we feel we have to do. But the only thing we really have to do is, one way or another, we have to liberate ourselves from all these compulsions. The goal of the spiritual path is to be free. It's a very important concept to understand, mukta. It's to be free, to be completely freed of all compulsions. Try to imagine one's life. Try to imagine your own life. Completely free of all compelling desires. It doesn't mean you don't act, but you don't act from compulsion. But these are not, as I say, there's no place you can put your hands on these. These are vibrations in the spine. Dissolve that vibration, and the compulsion is dissolved. And that is the technique of Kriya Yoga. Kriya Yoga is the art of running the energy up and down the spine in a particular way, in such a way, with all of the things that go with it, including receptivity to the grace of God through the presence of the Guru, and directly dissolving those vortices of committed energy so that we can then act from freedom. And this is the duty. This is the only duty that we are given. Maybe many other things manifest through us. We give birth to children. We have our artistic and creative desires. We have worldly ambitions, and they compel us, and we act them out. It's not wrong to do them. I know we learn by doing. We learn by putting the energy out. In the Gita, it speaks very strongly. You can't just say, oh, it's all a dream, therefore I'm going to do nothing. It talks about suppression itself is an action. You know, to suppress your desires is not doing nothing. It's being compelled by your desires in exactly the same way. Either to act on them or suppress them is to be compelled by them. To be completely free is the goal. And if it's it can't be suppressed, it needs to be acted out, but it needs to be acted out in such a way as the action itself brings you more and more freedom. That you begin to understand through everything you're doing that all is divine. Everything is divine. Everything is just a pathway to this infinite consciousness that the masters behind us radiate, rain upon us. We're being drenched at all times with this divine potential for cosmic consciousness. And the only limitation is our ability to receive it. And the limitation to that ability is self-imposed by all of these compelling karmas. But the end of the story is not a sad one. The end of the story is a glorious one, especially if we enter in and do our part as God has given us to do, to accept what the masters have taught us with devotion, with humility, with perseverance, with consistent practice of all the many different techniques that are available to us that gradually dissolve and unwind this lifetime-created karmic compulsion. And ultimately what happens, and this is the extraordinary part of it, which causes the true devotee, well, to fall on your knees in gratitude, is that at a certain point, all of this self-effort results not in this great conquest with exhausted force, like a person who runs a marathon and finally reaches the end of the line and just falls over the line completely spent. What happens is the more and more we work seemingly with our own effort is really to remove the obstacles to receiving that grace. And that's why devotees all talk about the grace of God. And you see that great devotees have worked so hard, seemingly, sacrificed so much, seemingly, dedicated themselves with such extraordinary effort. But in the end, all they speak about is the grace of God. Because all that effort is simply to hold oneself in complete readiness and love, to receive what God would have given us in the first moment if we weren't so deeply identified with other realities. And in that wonderful moment, all the masters tell us, you just look back and realize it was all just waves on the ocean. And no master, as Swamiji often says, ever says it was a bad deal. Feels like a bad deal from here. But when you finally reach the end of the story, you realize, oh, what a wonderful play. What a joyful and wonderful play. And the more we can adopt that attitude of devotion and gratitude, the more we can fulfill what the Bible promised, as many as received him, to them gave he the power to become infinitely free.